Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, to the final part of this BBC Prom, live here on Radio 3, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nusson. It's been quite a journey through four works receiving their first Prom's performances, and there's one more to come. So don't forget that if you'd like to have another listen, this concert will be available on the iPlayer for a week. Just go to bbc.co.uk/radio3 and the BBC Proms and then find the right one. Or you can hear it on Radio 3 itself again, Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Well, the main work coming up, the Symphony Schumann, was inspired to write by the sights and sounds of the Rhineland, particularly Cologne with its tremendous Gothic cathedral. Bernd Alois Zimmermann grew up in that city during the difficult period between the two world wars. Difficult or not, young Zimmermann would have had plenty of opportunities to hear the folk music of the Rhineland, particularly that performed traditionally at the festivities taking place during the carnival period before Lent, Cologne yielding to no one in the energy of its celebrations. Zimmermann's Rheinischer Kirmestänzer, Rhenish fair dances, seem to have originated in piano arrangements of folk tunes written some 60 years ago for radio broadcasts. Then, years later, when he was wrestling with his huge opera Die Soldaten, the soldiers, he decided to get away from its problems by doing something completely different, and he arranged the suite for 13 wind and brass instruments. Well, the composer Julian Anderson is listening to this Prom with me in the Radio 3 box. Julian, this is pretty different from most music by Zimmermann, a real piece of music or fun.
Yes, it's light music really, and it fulfills that purpose very, very elegantly. And in any style he wrote in, Zimmermann was an expert orchestrator. He knew instruments really inside out, and you hear the relish of sound and the enjoyment of writing and arranging these dances in a perfectly straightforward but very witty and inventive way.
Yeah, I mean, he treats the material with ironic irreverence. I mean, he spoke of himself, it's a bit like Poulenc, I suppose, as a mixture of Monk and Bacchus.
Yes, this is definitely the Bacchus side.
Yes. Isn't it just
as the last orchestral piece he wrote, Stille und Umkehr, Stillness and Return, is very much the Monk side. You know, in this piece, as in that one, rich colours, beautiful sensitivity, instrumental possibilities, never, never vulgar.
Do you know if he would have heard Kurt Weill, Hindemith, as a teenager? Do you detect anything like that?
Well, given when he was born, let me just do a quick bit of maths. I don't think as a teenager he could have done, because
they would already have.
They would have already, alas, have been banned by the Nazi regime, which traumatized his adolescence and early adulthood very badly. But he certainly would have heard them straight after the war, and he obviously knew their work. I wouldn't say this is that much like them, though. It's a straightforward, enjoyable rendition of some little folk tunes.
Perhaps it's more like Stravinsky Pulcinella, that kind of feel.
A little bit. Ollie Nusson said earlier today to me that he thought it actually resembled the sort of Malcolm Arnold Cornish dances type of thing, and I think that's true too. There's that. As I say, it is light music, beautifully done, very enjoyable.
Well, we're not just getting a Proms premiere tonight, but a world premiere. The double bass part wasn't included when these dances were published. This is its first performance, played by four of them in the first dance. It's completely manic. So here once again is Oliver Nusson to conduct members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Zimmermann's Rheinischer Kirmestänzer. Thank you. Real Weissbier and Bratwurst music. Wonderfully raucous wind band sounds from Bernd Alois Zimmermann in his Rheinische Kirmes-Tänzer, Rhenish Fair or Church Festival Dancers, performed here at the Royal Albert Hall for the first time at the Proms by members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nussen, and the double bass part not published and discovered in a manuscript version of the dances, given its world premiere by four members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra bass section. I think we can say that the players reacted to Ollie Nusson's remark at rehearsal today. By all means, err on the side of vulgarity tonight, and I won't be unhappy. It sounds awfully civilised, he said this morning. Bit more schwung, chaps, please. Well, he's back on the platform, bringing them all to their feet. Hope he's pleased with the schwung tonight. It's not just a love of the Rhineland, which Zimmermann and Schumann had in common, but bouts of severe depression, and Zimmermann took his own life in 1970 at the age of 52. Well, as I said, the final work in tonight's Prom was also inspired by the Rhineland. Schumann wrote his Third Symphony soon after he'd been appointed music director of the Rhenish city of Düsseldorf, at a time when the prestige and opportunities of the position seemed enticing and exciting, before he grasped quite how difficult it would all be for him. The single most important catalyst for the symphony was a trip Schumann made just upriver to Cologne, where the wonderful Gothic cathedral thrilled him, and in whose cavernous interior he witnessed the archbishop being solemnly invested as a cardinal. This symphony was the one time Schumann abandoned a four-movement structure. There are three inner movements, of which the last is that solemn, dignified portrait of the cathedral. The first and fifth are full of energy. On the one hand, maybe, a reflection of the strong current of the Rhine. But, Julian, surely there's more to the symphony than just pictures of the sights and sounds of the Rhineland. Perhaps odd to say of Schumann in a way, but this music's full of the sheer joy of life, isn't it?
Yes, well, that is a very important aspect of his creative personality. And, of course, the first movement is as a real headlong rush, marvellous, expansive music, which never seems to let go. As Stephen Johnson points out in the programme note, that Nielsen, Brahms, various other composers, obviously very struck by that. But the piece, yes, has its darker undertones, as Schumann usually does. And perhaps those come forward a little bit towards the end of the work in the finale and various other places.
The Rhine, of course, a very potent symbol to Germans. Calling it the Rhenish, also proclaiming his nationalism, do you think?
Yes, I think so. Of course, it didn't have the overtones nationalism and German nationalism in particular that it does now. But yes, this is clearly somebody saying this is the part of the world I feel most at home in, and relishing it in a rather idealistic vision, which, as you say, was not perhaps matched by the reality.
The symphony, another step in his quest for unification of his musical material in all his works?
Yes, well, he was often having these motto themes and idéfix and things that go through the piece, and that's the case here too. But also great diversity on the surface, a great diversity of mood and character and scoring.
Yes, Oliver Nussen says, or I think said to the orchestra, you know, think of it in terms of Mendelssohn rather than in terms of Brahms. It's that lightness you need in this, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well, we now, finally, you might say, have a classic symphony orchestra configuration on stage. It really has been, well, a very visual feast in all ways tonight, and I must say everybody's done amazingly well to get this programme on and up and running with a very patient Proms audience as well. Well, this symphony was introduced to the Proms by Henry Wood, what wasn't, in 1901, but it was over 50 years until its next performance. Well, to conduct the performance tonight, here comes the BBC Symphony Orchestra's Artist in Association, Oliver Nussle, bringing BBC Symphony Orchestra to its feet before he leads them in Schumann's Third Symphony, the Rhenish.
Thank you. Thank you.
A blazing end to Schumann's Salute to the Joys of Life and the Rhineland. In his third symphony, The Rhenish, it's been performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's three-part BBC prom by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Andrew Haber and conducted by Oliver Nussen. Well, Düsseldorf, not a great success for Schumann. He wasn't really a conductor. After 3 years as music director, he was forced to resign. But when you have a composer who can conduct like Oliver Nussen tonight, it does bring an extra dimension to the music. Well, my guest this evening, Julian Anderson, will be back here, I'm sure, on the 7th of August when the National Youth Orchestra, conducted by Semyon Bychkov, give the London premiere of his Fantasias. I hope it's a fantastic evening for you, Julian, and thank you so much for your company this evening.
Thank you so much.
Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back at the Proms on Monday when Jonathan Nutt conducts Ravel and Ligeti. It's joined by Pierre-Laurent Aimard for Mozart's Last Piano Concerto and the London premiere of George Benjamin's First. But as Oliver Nussen comes back onto the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall, time for me to leave you, just to tell you that in the first of tomorrow evening's two BBC proms, Paul Lewis continues his Beethoven piano concerto cycle with the second concerto. Rapturous applause for Oliver Nussen, trying to get the BBC Symphony Orchestra to stand. Finally, the principal cello does. Well, as I say, Andrews Nelson's and the CBSO tomorrow evening, including the Dvořák New World Symphony. That's at 7 tomorrow here in the Royal Albert Hall, live here on Radio 3. But for the moment, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as he was saying earlier on, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Monday afternoon, this coming Monday afternoon, at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, well, just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, in 5 minutes' time here on Radio 3, the BBC Proms composer portrait, Colin Matthews tonight, whose violin concerto you may have heard in the second part of tonight's prom. Colin Matthews in conversation with Tom Service. That's at 10:15. And then at 11, the essay this week about writers who play a musical instrument and how their playing relates to their lives as writers. Journalist Jasper Rees tonight about the challenge of relearning the French horn and even playing live at the Royal Festival Hall. That's the essay at 11 o'clock tonight. For the moment, back to Robert Schumann, one of his three romances, Opus 94, clarinetist Gervaise de Paille here with pianist Gwyneth Pryor. Robert Schumann, the last of his three romances, Opus 94, the clarinetist there, Gervaise de Pyre, with the pianist Gwyneth Pryor.
Sir Simon Rattle brings an evening of passion to the BBC Proms as he conducts the Age of Enlightenment, playing Wagner and Berlioz. Berlioz regarded the love scene from Romeo and Juliet as one of his greatest achievements and inspired Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. Hear both pieces in the company of Andrew McGregor at the BBC Proms this Sunday at 6:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
My apologies for the dropout at the start of that. It's 10:15 now, and now with the first of this year's BBC Proms composer portraits. It was recorded at the Royal College of Music before this evening's prom, during which we heard the violin concerto by Colin Matthews. Well, here's Colin Matthews now in conversation with Tom Service.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music for this first of four composer portraits of this year's proms. Tonight, the chamber music of Colin Matthews in the spotlight, with performances by students and fellows of the Royal Academy of Music, duos for cello, viola, violin and piano. And I'm delighted to be joined on stage here by Colin Matthews, who's also Prince Consort Professor at this very institution at the Royal College of Music. Look, Colin, we're going to start with one of your five duos, and the first of the enigmas for cello and piano. So just tell us briefly about these pieces before we hear them.
Yep, these are sets of respectively five pieces and three pieces for cello and piano, both of which date from the 80s, I think. The enigmas were written for Sandy Bailey, who gave the first performance of my first cello concerto at the Proms in 1984, and I think I wrote them in 1985. The duos were written for another cellist, Richard May, who gave the first performance around 89. And they're quite similar in mood. In fact, enigmas could have gone for all of them. They're pieces that I didn't want to give explanations for, and they're slightly cryptic. So we have the five duos, which are very... The first one, the duo, is very static, almost monodic in a way, with a long singing melodic line, and then it's followed by a very contrasting first of the enigmas, which contrasts pretty violent music with also relatively quiet and flowing music.
Fantastic. Well, let's given that you don't want to explain this enigma properly, then we should just hear the music, I think. Please welcome on stage Chris Hopkins, a pianist who will be playing for all of tonight's concert, and cellist Jonathan Rees.
Thank you.
Colin Matthews' Enigma No. 1 for cello and piano, and before that, the third of his five duos for cello and piano, played here at the Royal College of Music by cellist Jonathan Rees and pianist Chris Hopkins. Colin, one of the things I noticed from looking at your publisher's Faber Music's catalogue is that there's not a lot of music, published by them at least, before about the late-ish 70s or mid-70s, when you must have been 30, if my math is right. Mm-hmm. So what happened before then? what was going on?
I was a late starter. I was writing, I suppose, I started relatively late and didn't write anything that I would consider to have any value at all until sort of my early 20s. A few pieces of just I've salvaged, but it really was about 73, 74 when I actually found something like a voice. So there isn't anything that really survives before then.
I mean, one of the things you were doing at that time in your 20s was you had extremely close associations with Oprah, with Benjamin Britten, and with the music of Gustav Mahler, working on the completion of the Tenth Symphony. I mean, was part of that difficulty because you had these two huge musical behemoths who you had to somehow find your own way around as a composer, Mahler and Britten?
Not really, because, I mean, both of them were the most extraordinary things to be involved with. And, I mean, gave me a great deal to build on. I suppose you could say, I mean, it was at the same time rather off-putting because I could evaluate what I was doing. But, I mean, I've always tried to be as self-critical as possible, and I just simply wasn't writing the music that I felt was coming out right.
So what were you... what were the things that, you know, made you want to be a composer then, apart from what sounds like the obvious difficulty of of dealing with a personality as self-critical as yourselves, Colin?
What the real circumstance that made me become a composer, I think, was hearing a lot of Mahler in the centenary year of 1960. I mean, I'd been, like everybody, had learned piano at an early age, but I hadn't really seriously thought about what career I would want to follow. And a couple of experiences around that time, I mean, for instance, being actually present at the first public performance in this country of Mahler 3, and the first full performance of Schoenberg Gurrelieder, and those were such overwhelming experiences that, I came away from them just thinking there was nothing I wanted to do except compose, with very little ability or experience before then.
So I'm guessing there were a lot of sketches for vast choral and orchestral pieces.
Yeah, like everybody, yes.
So what about then that transition to the pieces that you did want to keep?
Well, the transition, I suppose, came from having found that although I was trying to work in a pretty intensely serial way, I was, I suppose, particularly influenced, I think, by the Maxwell Davis of the early 70s. But it just didn't seem to quite gel. And the strange juxtaposition was that about that time I came across minimalism in the form of Terry Riley in particular, and then the early Steve Reich. And it just pushed me into a direction where I could sort of cleanse the harmonic palette. I grew out of it very quickly, but it was a very youthful way of finding the way I wanted to work harmonically.
You see, Max and minimalism, that's a pretty unique compositional pedigree at that time, really anywhere, but in Britain especially. I mean, did you... how do you go about putting them together?
with difficulty, but I somehow came out the other side. I mean, the big seminal piece was my orchestral fourth sonata, which was completed in 1974. And I remember somebody, I think, who was actually being critical, described it as a mixture of Ligeti, Steve Reich, and Sibelius rescored by Leonard Bernstein. And although he actually meant it quite toughly, I was very pleased indeed with this because that's more or less what I was trying to do.
Those are pretty good names, too. Mm. I mean, you know. Listen, we change the scale. I was going to say alas, I don't mean that at all. It would be nice to hear the fourth sonata, but we're not going to hear that now. We're going to hear music for viola and piano, two pieces, Scorivoli and Calmo. Briefly, Colin, on those.
The remaining pieces that we're going to hear were all written as birthday presents to individuals. I've done a set of four violin pieces followed by four viola pieces. And in fact, these are the viola pieces are the relatively more recent. The two are Scorevole, which is a very fast, shadowy piece, and that's dedicated to my friend, the choreographer Ashley Page, on his 50th birthday, and a viola piece, Calmo, which was a birthday present for the Dutch conductor and composer Reinbert de Leeuw.
Fantastic. So to play them now on stage at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall here at the Royal College of Music, please welcome viola player Robert Ames and pianist Chris Hopkins. Thank you. Robert Ames, viola, and Chris Hopkins on piano. The two pieces by Colin Matthews, Calmo and Scorrevole. Colin, even in those two pieces we've heard, and the two cello pieces as well, there's a huge contrast going on between often music that with very fast music and very slow music. It's particularly the fast music that's intriguing, because you've written a lot of music. I'm thinking of works like the huge Song Cycle Continuum or bits of the Horn Concerto or an orchestral piece called Toccata Meccanica. Genuinely fast music, which there isn't a lot of in some kinds of new music. I mean, is it difficult to do, to write genuinely quick music?
I'm not sure. I find I'm very driven towards doing it. And in fact, what has been the problem for me is actually writing slow music, because I've got into the mode of writing fast. I mean, the particular problem is that it's very easy to write fast music, which is just a moto perpetuo or what I would call sort of running on the spot.
You mean like
just very fast figuration? But what is difficult? Yes, that the minimalism aspect of it. But what is difficult is to actually give this music a harmonic momentum, which actually allows it to have real pace rather than a sort of fake movement.
So how do you do it then?
Oh, I'm not giving away my tricks.
Okay. Well, maybe we can investigate Calmo a bit more then, because you're saying to me during rehearsal today that that's a piece that has been like a sort of seed since you wrote it about 10 years ago.
It was a very important piece for me, because I found a simplicity of harmonic language which I've been using even up to the violin concerto. I think I've now got to stop. But it's what I call a sort of blemished tonality, where the basic triadic shapes are always blemished by one of the, without getting too technical, one of the notes of the triad is blemished by a minor second, either above or below it. It can be in any position, but it actually became a very fruitful way of developing harmony. And it's been used, I used it in Continuum, which actually expands on Calmo, and in a piece, orchestral piece called Turning Point. And it's not so important in the violin concerto, but it's there still.
Colin, the sense about, okay, inventing these sorts of systems for the harmonic expression or whatever the technical language is, there must be an expressive reason, a poetic reason, or a human reason that you want to do this to get this stuff out. I mean, listening to Calmo just now, it seems to me, anyway, a kind of unafraidedly emotional, lyrical, moving piece of music.
Yes, but that for me is something that happens in retrospect. I mean, when I'm writing, it's purely a technical exercise. Sometimes when people have asked this, I've quoted Tchaikovsky, who said at some point, you know, when I am least emotional, I am writing my most emotional music.
I wasn't suggesting necessarily that there's an autobiographical or a kind of, you know, a confessional aspect to this to your music, but rather, you know, there is there's an expressivity about this music.
Well, I do find that very important, that although it's great fun to be able to work on your own and do things which are technically very challenging and enjoyable to do, I'm aware that these things can become very dry and abstract. And I suppose one of the things I've been trying to do for a long while is to write music which is expressive, but not simply expressive. I mean, I like the expression to be complex and to be able to draw people in and to make them think. I don't want it to be too easy.
We're all finding it very easy here tonight. That richness is I think we can hear very clearly in the next couple of pieces, the violin and piano pieces, Chaconne with chorale and Moto Perpetuo, especially that Chaconne with chorale. It comes from a very, seems to be a kind of deep and dark place.
I suppose so. Again, these are birthday present pieces. That the Chaconne was written as an 85th birthday present, I think, for Bertolt Goldschmidt, with whom I worked for many years on Mahler 10. He conducted the first performance in 1964. Was a composer who whose music was completely forgotten until the 90s. In fact, I only discovered it. My brother and I used to go and visit him, and we had no idea that he was actually a major composing figure. He didn't talk about it at all, and gradually it emerged. And then he suddenly produced these scores, which had been published by Universal Edition in the 1920s, and we discovered, you know, what a major composer he was. So he was a close friend and a remarkable person to get to know. He was a particular master of the Chaconne, and so when I wrote a birthday tribute for him, I wrote what is quite a complicated Chaconne. It's quite hidden, but there is a pattern that runs through the whole thing, and a chorale in the middle, which is actually rhythmically completely free. It's up to the players to how they place it.
And Moto Perpetuo, as you'll hear, is in classic fast Matthews mode, right?
Yeah, and that was written for Elliot Carter's wife, Helen, and was an attempt to sum up. She was a remarkably energetic figure, even into her 90s, and this was meant to sum up some of her energy.
So to play both these pieces, then Chaconne with chorale and Moto Perpetuo, violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins. Colin Matthews, Moto Perpetuo, and before that, Chacon with chorale for violin and piano. Violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins. We're returning in a way to really one of your musical roots of the final piece we're just about to hear in tonight's programme, your arrangement of the final movement of Britten's Opus 60 Nocturne. What does this piece mean to you, Colin?
Well, I thought this evening I really should end with something by Britten because he's been such a major part of my life. And this is a fusion of Britten and Mahler because the Nocturne is dedicated to Mahler's widow, Alma. And I think that the final movement is perhaps Britten at his most Mahlerian. And I wrote this, in fact, this is yet another birthday present because it was for the chairman of the Britten Pierce Foundation, Robert Carmuth, for his 60th birthday, and he's an amateur violinist. I thought it would be appropriate to make an arrangement of the sonnet from the Nocturne.
Britten, Mahler and Matthews. Violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins with Colin Matthews' arrangement of Britten's Nocturne, Opus 60, the sonnet, the final movement.
Thank you.
Colin Matthews' arrangement of the final sonnet from Benjamin Britten's Nocturne, Opus 60. Violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins. Well, that's the end of this first composer portrait event of the BBC Proms 2010. Three more to look forward to through the rest of the season. My thanks to all of the musicians from the Royal Academy of Music who we've heard this evening. Chris Hopkins, Charlotte Reed, Robert Ames on viola, and cellist Jonathan Rees. Of course, to Colin Matthews for being with us tonight, and to you all, ladies and gentlemen, for being here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music. Thank you all.
And that BBC Proms composer portrait of Colin Matthews was presented by Tom Service.
Vigour and adventure course through the Royal Albert Hall in tomorrow's BBC Prom. Joins the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra performing Beethoven's second piano concerto. Katie Durham is your host for the BBC Proms tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening, it's coming up to 1 minute past 11. And now the essay. This week, four writers are revealing an alternative talent for performing music. How did they start? How did they keep going? And a good deal more. Tonight, journalist Jasper Rees takes up the theme in When Writers Play.
But do you still play? I get that one all the time. You took up your old instrument, they say. You wrote a book about it, then co-wrote a stage version. But do you still play? It's a very good question. My relationship with the musical instrument I learnt at school has been an off-and-on affair, the stress being on the off. I dropped the French horn like a stone after 7 years' desultory toil the second I left school. In this I know I am not alone. University beckoned, and beyond it lay life, the universe and everything. My old horn didn't really have a part to play in that future. Or not so far as I knew. I associated my youthful music-making with confusion and stress, fecklessness and trauma. Who on earth would volunteer to carry a sackload of that into adulthood? Of course, I didn't leave it entirely behind. Hearing the strains of a velvety solo on a Hollywood soundtrack, the horn being the only instrument you can pick up over a car chase, would be like bumping into a distant cousin at a family wedding in which the words spoken between us would go something like, "Great to see you again. We must get together sometime." While the unspoken ones would say the opposite. "No, we really mustn't." I went back to my French horn when I was on the verge, the very ledge of middle age. Let's not go deep into what lured me. Unfinished business? Couldn't afford a Harley? It helped that I had belatedly fallen head over heels in love with classical music. There was also a pregnant whiff of self-reproach at the heart of my decision. Once upon a time, I told myself, you didn't give this instrument your best shot. So down came the horn case from the attic. In the cinematic version of this moment, the lid would open towards the camera, and the glow from within the case would irradiate my face like Indiana Jones finding the Ark of the Covenant, or Fagin inspecting his glittering jewels. And my old instrument, made by Josef Liedl from what was once Czechoslovakia, did indeed gleam after 22 years in the dark. The sound I produced on it did not. What happened next is another story. I found myself enlisting for the British Horn Society's annual festival. Euphoric after joining in with a massed hornblow, I challenged myself to return in a year and perform the Mozart concerto I had distressingly butchered in a school competition at the age of 17. Daring do, I should add, is not really my thing. Not my forte, if you will. It's probably why I failed as a horn player in the first place. On top of ability, you need practically toxic levels of self-belief to master this above all instruments. It's very, very easy to sound bad on the French horn. That mouthpiece is punitively narrow. With such a small space for the embouchure to work in, a note will often come up with a crack running right down the middle of it. A split, we call it here. Or in America, a clam. The higher you go, the easier it is to split. And the more you split, the more the mouthpiece becomes the focal point for intense levels of physical and psychological pressure, resulting in yet further technical vulnerability. And so on. At least as a writer, it was possible for me to work on these things in the privacy of the professional day. I did my practice away from ears that might have been offended, and scrambled methodically up from a subterranean level of competence. My guide was Dave Lee, an earthy eminence grise of the horn world, who also became a drinking companion. There are splinter groups who believe in yoga and meditation, but alcohol, explained Dave, carefully over a bottle of wine, is the recommended tranquilizer for most horn players after a concert. Sometimes it works before, too. I also listened to Dave's pertinent advice on breathing and fingering, trilling and tonguing. In the months that followed, a little miracle happened. I made a place in my heart for the French horn that the 15-year-old me had denied it. Curious to locate the source of my intoxication, I went to the history books. In rarely thumbed tomes, summoned from the basement of the British Library, I found my explanation. The sound that emerges through the horn's narrow mouthpiece, the slender lead pipe, and 16 further feet of tubing before it flares past the player's right hand and out of the bell, is unique. Where other orchestral instruments produce a noise that is the result of a process of manufacture, the horn is recognisably a descendant of man's first conical instrument. As I improved, I began to understand that I was rejoining a line of music makers which reaches all the way back to that first Stone Age man who picked up a ram's horn and blew into it. My first hurdle was to sound better than the priests who destroyed the walls of Jericho. Gradually thereafter, it was to improve on all the hornsmen from the instrument's prehistory. The Celts, the Romans, the Vikings, and of course Count Roland summoning Charlemagne's reinforcements to the battlefield with a temple-splitting blast on his olifant. The horn disappears from history for most of a millennium until it crops up again on the hunting fields of France. It was this sound to which Mozart paid ebullient tribute in his four horn concertos. The joy of returning was unconfined. As I disinterred the dormant musician inside me, I felt that I was somehow making amends for bygone failures. It would be a mistake to claim that I soared to new heights. All I know is that I became a much more dedicated horn player the second time around. I did that thing that most teenagers never quite find time for. I practiced my socks off. a routine was established. Grappling with the horn was my respite for an hour, or more often two, from day-long attendance at the keyboard and screen. All writers have consciously elected to spend their days alone, but some of us do crave company. Mine came from the French horn, from Mozart, and by extension from Josef Leutgeb, the Viennese cheesemonger and old family friend for whom he dashed off the concertos. On the 27th of May, 1783, the composer famously scribbled at the top of the first concerto he completed, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart takes pity on Josef Leutgeb, ass, ox, and fool. I know this is a solipsism, but it felt as if Mozart had taken pity on me too. All those epithets certainly applied to my horn playing. The ass, ox, and fool in me was most apparent when I accepted an invitation to join an amateur orchestra. I shipped up to the first rehearsal to discover that while there was a full complement of strings and a cross-section of woodwinders, the only other brass player was a trombonist parked at the far end of the empty back row. I was to be first, second, third, and indeed fourth horn. I soon recalled that sight reading was never one of my strengths, nor was counting, and nor, worst of all, was transposing. A look of deep befuddlement settled on my face until the interval, whereupon I scarpered in shame. If I was in over my head, most of the time I just ignored the evidence. Over the year, I globetrotted around the horn world and met the top players from Los Angeles to St. Petersburg. The consensus among soloists and section players was that I had probably bitten off more than I could chew in a year. But if I was to persevere, it would be a good idea to get a feel for playing in front of an audience. The first time I gave a public account of K447, Mozart's third horn concerto, the small gathering of listeners were mostly under 12. That didn't prevent the instrument from juddering in my hands as if in the grip of a poltergeist. My daughters and nieces and nephews listened for 15 interminable minutes as I sacrilegiously overrode Dennis Brain piped through the speakers on my MP3 player. The weeks and months whistled by. Eventually, I was left with no further alternative but to return to the British Horn Society's annual festival and walk on stage, alone, in front of some of the best horn players in existence. As nuts and bolts came loose in the early part of my performance, I screamed abuse at myself behind an impassive face. But I do also remember thinking that while this feels like a disaster now, it will probably be worth writing about. When people ask me what I got out of playing Mozart in public, the answer comes in several parts. I basked in the warm glow of applause, which we all need now and then. I also had the equal fulfilment of describing my musical journey. And then an actor called Jonathan Guy Lewis asked me if we could make a play out of it. Every time audiences cheer Jonathan playing me playing Mozart, an original hunch of mine is reconfirmed. This is much more than my story. There is a silent army of lapsed musicians out there who carry a cargo of regret deep into middle age. I always say the same thing to them. You can always go back and have another go, you know. If I can, you can. I very much doubt you'll regret it. They're the ones who ask me, but do you still play? To which the answer is, I do. But not with quite the same intensity. I meet up with another returning horn player for duets and drinking. In private, it's permissible to do both at the same time. And I'm slowly working on Beethoven's Lone Horn Sonata, the one composed for the great Giovanni Punto. A friend has been given the piano part. We'll meet up at some point, once I've conquered the nasty crop of semiquavers towards the end of the first movement, and perform to an audience of none. I played in public for the last time at a gathering to celebrate the publication of my book. There's an arrangement for 8 horns of Mozart's most popular horn rondo, the one Flanders and Swan turned into the song from which I got my title. I found my horn. That evening, I hired some horn students to be my backing band while Dave and I shared the solo part. As we all stood on a small raised stage in front of my family and friends, galloping through this glorious and much-loved hunting tune, there was only one thought running through my head. It doesn't get any better than this.
Jasper Riis was reading his essay in the series When Writers Play, and of course we heard his performance at the end there too. There's no programme tomorrow as we've a late night prom by the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, but the essay returns on Friday evening when it's the turn of historian Neil Ferguson. That's at the same time, 11 o'clock on Friday evening here on BBC Radio 3.
A celebration of the genius of Stephen Sondheim. An amazing cast performs songs from some of his best-loved shows with the BBC Concert Orchestra and conductor David Charles Abell.
Well, Stephen Sondheim creates a unique sound world for each of his musicals. And for Little Night Music, it's the world of the Viennese Waltz. For Sweeney Todd, it's sort of shock horror movie music. And for Company, it's 70s contemporary sound. It's going to be a joy to create all those worlds with the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is the ideal instrument to do all those different styles.
Sondheim at 80 in the BBC Proms, Saturday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
11:15 now, and now Late Junction with Fiona Talkington.
Vintage South African music from the Umbakanga tradition, which in Zulu literally means steamed mealy bread. So it was the music of the people, the Umgababa queens and Maputi. And welcome tonight to Late Junction. There's more from WOMAD later on at around 12:30, from a fabulous Finnish duo who were on the Radio 3 stage on Saturday, the accordionist Markku Lepisto and bass player Pekka Lehti. And this band was how the two met.
Synnyntäsi maan kavala kasvantasi, maaston muutkin matoset kirjavatkin käärmehet. Enpä tiedä karvoasi, mikä karva lienetkää on, vaikka yhdeksi karva, musta karva, harmia karva, vaikka vasken karva. Pirun riivattu purjaet, veri miun vereläet, liho miun lihalasiessa, haselkä sisäsi ja pitkä hammas paholainen. Mä metsähän mäelle, pakene pajun vesoille, luikera kivien kolohen, musta mato, mä mullan alle vie vaiva, männessäs kipu kova kulkeissas, noille tappotanterille, vaino vaivoille sijoille. Puista purema paha poista myrkky myötä möiten, äläkä enää ehätä, tule näille nurkkiloille, ruma roikalle, luikertele, pirun riivattu purja, et veri miun verellä, et liho miun lihalasi, haselkä sisäsi ja pitkä hammas paholainen. Metsään mäelle, vakelle pajun vesoille, luikera kivien kolo on musta mato, nää mulla alle.
casting ancient spells on us. The Finnish band Vartina from their CD Ilmatar from, oh, that's 10 years ago now, featuring Markku Lepistö on accordion and Pekka Lehti on bass. And Markku and Pekka, or Lepistö and Lehti as they like to be known, were on the Radio 3 stage at WOMAD on Saturday, and I'll play you something from the very beautiful duo they formed later on tonight. And there's more Finnish music later on as well. Something now from a lifetime's treasure chest of field recordings by David Fanshawe, who died recently. Words are all very well, but a man must work to be strong. Athman bin Khamis, accompanied by the uta, a one-stringed harp, expressing joy at the harvest of coconuts in Kenya.
Akazalika kwa kike na kiumeni Yako kushikwa na humala kontu muoni Upita vati kuzuma ni nani ule ni nani Hae Hao Haya Hao Hao Mwanangu vapembe Lia mkupembe Kimango sinachwe moyo keke sinizwe unga Mishani na nsumeno itindao mbele na nyumba Kurorangoma si hata kangia katika vina Oh, engoma Aya, engoma, goma Kio ngoma, kesho ngoma Nantondo, ngoma tena Aho, aho, aho
Every heart in his crown I will sway over all others above, how my heart